really begins to apply what he has been teaching up to this point. And we've talked about this before in regard to Paul's letters, that very often they break down into what is more of a teaching section and what is more of an application section. And
that's obviously a gross oversimplification of what Paul is doing. He obviously does applying in the teaching section and teaching in the applying section, but for the most part, that's a fair assessment of what goes on in the majority of Paul's letters, and that's what we find here as well. As beginning in chapter 4, he really begins to drive to the practical point of what they need to be doing as it regards to what he's been teaching them all along. And what he has drawn a picture of up to this point in Ephesians, obviously he's talked about the great blessings that we've been blessed with. He's spoken of an alien society that's been reconciled back, this group of Gentiles that they were alienated from the people of God. They've been reconciled now to God. It was a picture of a fractured humanity that now has been united, a new humanity that has now been created. And he's moving now as he progresses from the picture of this new society and who it is and how it has been recreated to what it is supposed to be and the standards that God expects of the people that are in his society. And so he's moved from, you might say he's moved from exposition to exhortation. He's not describing it anymore. He's telling them what they need to be in that society, doctrine to application, teaching to practical purpose. And it really does fit the picture of just good teaching in general, that, you know, we don't come up with practical application points out of thin air. Preaching that's just all practical application, that's not based on anything, is pretty worthless preaching. It begins in the text. It begins in the teaching of showing what God expects and what that builds from. And ultimately, Christian conduct follows from Christian teaching. That's where it comes from, and that's what Paul does over and over and over in all of his letters. Well, that kind of gets us to where we are here in Ephesians chapter 4. We'll go ahead and read the first six verses. That's what we'll be talking about today. I'll read them all together here at the outset. I, therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all, and through all, and in all. And what we're going to see in these first six verses, as Paul is beginning this section, is a call, first of all, to unity. And that's going to be the theme of not just these first few verses, but really the first half of this chapter. And we're going to come back and talk about the unity that we're being called to more next time as well. But what he begins by saying is, again, he reminds them that he is this prisoner for the Lord. And you can look at this in a couple of different ways, really. And I'm not sure if it's intended to be ambiguous so you can see both of these, or if one or the other is what Paul had in mind when he wrote it. But you could think of Paul being a prisoner for the Lord in terms of him being a prisoner of Christ. That just as he is a slave of Christ, that in that same kind of way he's bound to Christ by the chains of love, and he is a prisoner of Christ in that kind of way. You could also look at it very practically speaking in terms of him writing from a prison cell in Rome, where he writes Ephesians and several others of his letters, that he is a prisoner for Christ, quite literally. That he is in custody because he has been loyal to the gospel, because he has preached the gospel, and that has gained him enemies that led ultimately to his arrest. But he reminds them of this here at the outset as he is beginning to apply this. And I think that kind of has the effect of saying, listen, this is just how serious Christianity is. It's not something that you just dabble around in. It's not something that you make light of. It is something that you are a prisoner to, and you are willing to become a prisoner for if you are going to be this kind of person. And it gives that kind of note of the utmost seriousness to the points that he's going to be drawing from this point. And it's made serious again when he says, I urge you to do these things, to walk worthy of the calling is what he will say specifically here in this instance. And it's kind of, again, a shift of what he has done and what he is doing in his letter. He has first taught them, he has also prayed for them, and now he is going to appeal to them and he is going to exhort them. And it is this shift of what he is doing and how he is trying to do it, but it's all part of the same plan in trying to accomplish God's work in them and get them to grow into the kind of people that they should be. But just as good application follows from good teaching, so also, I guess, a practical lesson to any teachers, any preachers, may be to look at instruction and intercession and exhortation as something of a formidable trio for any teacher of God's people. That it's not enough to just teach people information. It's not just enough to be a motivational speaker and encourage them to do things. It's not enough to just pray for them. And probably if you're doing only two of those things, that's not enough of what you need to be doing for that group of people. But when you put all of these things together, you're really doing just about everything you can to try to get the group to grow, and that's what you see Paul doing here as well. Well, on to the point itself, Paul urges them to walk worthy of the calling. And that's one of those kind of relational statements that, to say I'm urging you to walk worthy of the calling is going to depend a whole lot on what that calling is, what it means to walk worthy of it. Because there are some callings that it won't take a whole lot to walk worthy of that sort of calling. But when you're talking about the call to be a Christian, obviously this is a divine calling. It is a calling to follow in the footsteps of a crucified Christ who gave himself fully for you. To walk worthy of that calling is a whole different kind of thing than to walk worthy of the calling to be a sanitation engineer. Obviously that's not the same high level of calling as the call to be a Christian. And Paul's going to go on to clarify, really there are two things specifically that he will focus his energy on through most of the rest of the epistle in terms of what it means to walk worthy of the calling. First is this picture of being one people, being a single family of God's people. And then second, it is going to be a holy people, to be distinct from the world, to be set apart, to belong to God. And so God's people, they're called to be a united people. They're called to be a holy people. So to walk worthy of that calling means that they must manifest their unity. They must truly be this united people. And we're called to be this holy people, and so we must manifest our purity. We must actually be that pure people. We must walk worthy of that calling in that kind of way. And so then this is how the book of Ephesians will break itself down. What we'll talk about tonight and next time is Paul emphasizing this picture of being a united people. And then from verse 17 through at least the end of chapter 5, probably on into the specific relationships as well, and at the beginning of chapter 6 would fit that picture as well of being a holy people in every kind of way as well. So that's what we're going to see Paul applying this message of how we are to walk worthy. And then as you look at these verses a little bit more specifically, not as closely as we will look at them, but we will see that there are a few things, four truths, I say, that are kind of the basis of walking worthy of this calling. First of all, it depends on the charity of our character and our conduct, and that's what we'll see specifically spelled out in verse 2, and we'll talk about that some. Second, our unity arises from the unity of God. It's not just some unity that we've come up with on our own. It's not something that we accomplish because we're such great united people, but it ultimately is rooted in the unity of God Himself, and that's how far we'll get this evening. But looking forward to next week as well, it's enriched by the diversity of our gifts. So at least in some sense, there is unity and diversity. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about verses 7 through 12. And then also it demands the maturity of our growth, as we'll see in verses 13 through 16. So that's kind of a map of where we're going, both in terms of unity and purity, and then in terms of looking at the unity a little bit more specifically. as well. Well, the rest of this evening we'll be talking about verses 1 through 6 specifically, but before I slow down and look at that in more detail, any questions or comments? Yes, sir.
The word calling there can also be translated as vocation. Now, avocation is what you do to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Vocation is your manner of life 24/7.
Tom?
There's three other passages that talk about walking, you know, in a worthy manner. Colossians, we walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. In 1 Thessalonians, it's walking in a manner worthy of God who calls us. And in Philippians 1, the living in a manner worthy of the gospel. And I think the word worthy is a little unfortunate, because when we talk about being worthy, most people position that sense of worth in themselves. But the question really is, where is that value of worth to be found? And for Paul, of course, it's in God or the gospel. That's where the value is. That's where the worth is. And we are called to live in a way that lives up to the value or the worth of the gospel. I think the same thing is true when Paul talks about partaking of the Lord's Supper in a worthy manner in 1 Corinthians 11. He's not talking about anyone being qualified to eat the Lord's Supper or has earned the right by virtue of some great worth that they have. But it's partake of it in a manner that's consistent with the value or worth that God has assigned to it. And as you pointed out, that's the practical implication of what we're called to, is to live this kind of life.
Worthy can also mean appropriately, with a specific reason.
Yeah. Anything else while we're stopped here? Adam, you look like you want to say something.
I was just going to say the calling. It reminds me of what Paul says in Philippians when he says, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God. So I get the sense that in Paul's mind, he's not just talking about, you know, your calling for, like the way we use the word calling. It's more of a literal God calling you to be with him through imitating the path of Jesus.
Yeah. Anywhere else we need to go? All right. Well, verse 2, follows up this urging to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you've been called. He says, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love. And this is this first point that I'm saying, is that our unity depends on the charity of our character and our conduct. What it is all rooted in at the most fundamental level is having the character of love for one another. And of course, and we've talked about this, I'm sure, plenty of times as well, when the Bible talks about love, it's not talking about syrupy, emotional, February the 14th love. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's not what the Bible's talking about. It's talking about a manner of life, of being sacrificial of yourself, of putting others before yourself. Loving as God loved is the fundamental picture of that. And that's spelled out very clearly by the words that are used to describe this kind of character as well. But this love is the fundamental element. And ultimately, it follows right on the heels of him saying that the prayer at the end of chapter 3, that we would be rooted and grounded in love was the prayer for the Ephesians. And now he says that we are to have this attitude of love. And specifically, he says there are these kinds of character traits that show you to be walking worthy of the calling. And the first one is this idea of humility, or lowliness, your translation may say. And this is one of those interesting words, because it's one of those words that we think of in a very positive kind of sense. If you talk about someone being humble, unless you're just, you know, the biggest jerk in the world, being humble is a good thing. And everyone thinks that being humble is a good thing. But in the mind of the Greeks, being humble was not a good thing. It was a word that was very rarely, if ever, used in the context of approval, even less used of admiration. It meant this kind of abject, subservient attitude, the crouching submissiveness of a slave. is the way it's been described by one commentator. Here it's this idea of having a lowly sort of mind, the humble recognition of the worth of other people, valuing others above yourself. The kind of humble mind that Christ had, I think, ultimately is the picture that led him to empty himself and to become a servant. It's the same word that's used in Philippians 2 to describe Christ in that context. And ultimately, this kind of humility is a very natural reaction to being a Christian. If you are truly following a crucified Christ and you are taking up your cross, then you're going to have the same kind of attitude that Christ had. That's a natural part of that sort of process. But also it's a natural part of the Christian life if you understand the greatness and the glory and the holiness of God. And this is something that I don't know that any of us will ever truly understand on this side of the grave, but it is something you see very clearly in the Bible. Anytime that anyone gets even the slightest glimpse of the glory of God, it's not just this amazing faith-building, uplifting experience that we might think it would be to see the glory of God. It's a terrifying, humbling, fear-inducing experience where all they think is, I'm so unworthy, I'm going to die because I'm a terrible, terrible person, and I've seen the glory of God. And that's even the slightest glimpse. That's nowhere near the fullness of God's glory. And so the closer we come to understanding that, in what limited way we may be able to do so, the more natural reaction we are going to have to humble ourselves before God. To think less of ourselves, to think more of others. And this obviously is something that is going to be part of being a united group of people, because any instance of disunity you can think of, somewhere behind that is pride. Almost certainly, if not certainly, every time there is discord, there is pride behind it somewhere. And humility is the single greatest secret to unity. That's what Paul is talking about in Philippians chapter 2 when he goes on to give that example of Christ being this supreme example of humility. He begins that by saying this is the kind of attitude that you need to have. Why? Because you need to be this united group of people is where that chapter begins. And so if we give others our respect, if we recognize their God-given worth, if we are humble people, we will promote unity, and that's the first stage in being the united people that we should be here. After that, he says gentleness or meekness. This is another word we've talked about a fair number of times, that meekness is, of course, not the same thing as weakness. Aristotle defined meekness, for what it's worth, as the mean between being too angry and never being angry at all. And I don't know that that's a bad way of understanding what it is. It's a word that is used of in the Greek. It's a word that's used of domesticated animals, strength under submission to will. And that's really, I think, what meekness is as much as anything. It's not being weak and not having the ability to do anything. It's having strength, yet having the gentleness and the control to not just wield it whenever you think you need to wield it. It's having strength and controlling that strength. It's really the exact picture of Jesus on the cross, who has the ability to come down from there if he so chose, yet he, being one who was meek and lowly in heart, chose to remain and not wield that strength. And that's, it's one thing to, be persecuted and not do anything to stop the persecutors because you don't have the ability to stop the persecutors. There's nothing special about that at all. That just means you're weak and you can't do anything. And if you're sitting there stewing about the fact that you wish you could do something about it, but you can't, then really there's nothing to boast in being persecuted. But when you're being persecuted and you have the ability, for whatever reason, to stop it, to put those people in their place, yet you humbly accept it because you're being persecuted for righteousness' sake, that's what meekness is. It's having the strength and not using it because of a greater purpose being served. Shane?
Example wild animal, you know, is tamed to the point where it can hold a rider, and that rider can control that massive animal with that tiny little rein. That horse has been meek. That horse has ever been as strong, every bit as viable as it was before, but now it's under control. And that horse allows itself to be directed by just a small rein. And so that term, that always helps me to kind of put a picture on what meekness is. It's not, that horse is not weak, but it allows itself to be controlled.
Thank you. Guy?
It seems to me that the topic of the sentence is bearing with one another. And that's where the lowliness, the gentleness, the long-suffering, the patience, and love come in. Because, as Paul pointed out in Romans and Corinthians, we have among every group of Christians those who are weak, not only in understanding, but also sometimes practicing what God has taught. And these characteristics are needed in us to be able to help them.
And ultimately, the idea behind the whole thing is still this picture of being the united people that we are supposed to be. And the idea that runs behind that is having the loving attitude that we should have. And yeah, certainly I don't want to suggest that these are four distinct things that, you know, you could have one without having the other. They're all ultimately built out of the same mindset and part of the same thing. But yeah, definitely the idea of patience and long-suffering, of bearing with one another, are as much as anything the picture of this. But you're not going to get to having the patience and the forbearing attitude that you should have if you're not the humble and meek person that you should be. And ultimately, again, the character that runs trait that runs through all of it is the love that stands behind it that allows you to be this kind of person. If there is any difference at all between being long-suffering and bearing with one another, it may just be the kind of person that you're dealing with. The idea of bearing with one another being a more general, it just takes patience to bear with people because people are people. Being long-suffering may have more of an attitude of dealing with specific kind of people that make you suffer more than other kinds of people do. But I don't know that there is intended to be some sharp distinction between those two attitudes. Obviously, they form a pair. Humility and meekness form a pair. Patience and forbearing form a pair. And I think it's really just different ways of talking about the same kind of attitude of love that is exhibited in a Christian family if you're going to have the sort of unity that you need to have in the first place. Well, that's what I've got to say about verse 2. We'll spend the rest of our time this evening on verses 3 through 6, where I think it gets a little more interesting, perhaps. But before we move on, any last thoughts on this picture of the love that we should have that fosters this kind of unity?
Well, maybe to simplify, I don't want to put words in Guy's mouth, but at least this is what it made me think of. The command is to walk in a manner worthy of the calling. The participle he gives about bearing with one another is an explanation of what specifically he has in mind. The way we walk worthy is by putting up with one another. And that's a synonym for forgiveness. That's ultimately the highest expression of love, of humility. And the way we're able to do that is with these attributes. We have love, we have patience, we have meekness, we have humility. Those are the things that equip us to be able to be forgiving toward one. And then there's going to be a second participle in verse 3, which you might see as saying the same thing in another way, doing our best to preserve the unity of the Spirit. That focuses more on the result or the consequence when we walk in a manner that is forgiving toward one another. So it is a fascinating summary of what walking worthy of Christ is. I mean, you think about, if you ask a lot of Christians, make up a list of what it would be to walk a worthy life in Christ. And you know, I'll go to church and read your Bible and pray a lot. But Paul boils it down to forgive one another.
Yeah.
Be the people of God you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
The last verse kind of sums it up. Be kind to each other.
Yeah. Anything else? Well, now that I look at my notes, for some reason I have verses 4 through 6 before verse 3 in my notes, and I'm sure that there was some harebrained, brilliant idea that I had in my mind when I put that together the first time, and I have no idea what it is now. So for whatever reason, we'll look at verses 4 through 6 before we come back to verse 3. That makes a whole lot of sense. Well, verses 4 through 6, there is one body and one spirit, just as you were called to one hope that belongs to your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. And what I think is going on here as much as anything, before we get down to the different ones, is just this picture of the connection between our unity and the unity of God. And again, it's this idea that our unity doesn't come because we're just such great, wonderful, united kinds of people that we've got this, you know, down so great because we're just that marvelous sort of people, but it is rooted in the unity of God Himself. And I think that becomes more clear as you look at it. There are seven different ones in this text, three of which allude to God, or the persons of the Godhead. There is one Spirit, verse 4. There is one Lord, verse 5. There is one God and Father, verse 6. And Lord there almost certainly refers to the Lord Jesus, in part because it's bracketed by the Spirit and the Father, and so the Lord would make sense to refer to Jesus. On top of that, in most instances, when Paul uses the word Lord, he is referring to Jesus as opposed to God the Father. That's just how he uses that terminology, typically speaking. And so the three ones there refer to the three persons of the Godhead. The other four allude to what we might call the Christian experience in relation to the persons of the Godhead. That is the aspects of our life as Christians and how they relate to each element of God. And perhaps it's better just spelled out rather than trying to explain it. So there is one body because there is one Spirit. Those are the two things that go together here at the outset. There is one body and one Spirit. And obviously those two ideas go together throughout the whole Bible. A body and a spirit, they go together. So there's this one body of God's people because there is one Spirit. The one body is the church, of course, the body of Christ. That's explained to us, if nothing else, in chapter 1 of Ephesians. And ultimately, the unity, the cohesion of the body is resulting in the fact that the Spirit dwells in the body. And that tells us, among other things, the church can't be just merely an organization, a man-made thing, if it has the Spirit of God dwelling in it. But also, there is one hope belonging to our Christian calling, and one faith and one baptism, because there is one Lord. Because Christ is the object of the faith and the hope and the baptism of all Christian people. It is Christ who we have believed. It is Christ into whom we have been baptized. And Christ is the one for whose coming we wait with expectant hope. And so those three ideas all at least potentially relate directly to the second person of the Godhead listed here, and that is Christ Himself, the one Lord, as Paul uses the language. And then finally, there is just a picture of the unity here as we are described as us all, and I think it's a picture, an implied group, the one family that embraces all of us. And the reason there is this one family that embraces us all is because there is one God and Father who is above all and through all and in all. And this picture of there being this one Father who is above all and in all and through all should ultimately bind us as a group closer than any human tie possibly could. We live in a God-created, God-controlled, God-sustained, God-filled world. And if we are God's body on the earth, how could we possibly be in discord with one another? And to allow silly things to divide us is utter folly and brings our message really to naught as we're trying to take it to the world. And so, in sum here, the one Father creates the one family, the one Lord Jesus creates the one faith, hope, and baptism, the one Spirit creates the one body. At least that's how I'm presenting it. And then ultimately, I think the point is that there can only be one Christian family, one Christian body, one Christian faith, one Christian hope, one Christian baptism, because there is only one God. And this, I think, also shows us something about the nature of the one God, that He is even here described in terms of the three persons of God, as the main point is that God is one. And that tells us that there's no contradiction, as difficult as it may be for us to understand it. There is no contradiction between the three persons of the Godhead and there being one God. If Paul's using those same kinds of language here in this same place, here's the point I want you people to understand. There's only one God, so you need to be united. By the way, there's three gods. Either Paul is just, you know, slow, or there's no contradiction, and it's just a difficult sort of thing for us to grasp, perhaps. But basically, the point is that you can't multiply churches any more than you can multiply gods. If God is one, then He has one church. The unity of God cannot be broken, then neither can the unity of the church be broken, which isn't to say that people don't try, but that's not what God has in mind, and that's not what is pleasing to Him. And so we shouldn't let any silly little thing divide us. I mean, you look at Paul writing to the church in Corinth. If there's ever a good occasion for a holy man of God to say, "Forget you people, I'm writing you off," the church in Corinth is a pretty good example of what that would have been. But Paul writes to them and pleads with them and exhorts them to straighten themselves out rather than saying, "I'm done with you all because you're a bunch of rotten pagans that are, you know, doing all the bad things they were doing." Yeah?
Just a quick question. Back up in verse 3 when he talks about the bond of peace.
Yes, verse 3.
Is bond, is that, at least in the Greek, a reference back to the prisoner, the bond of the original peace?
I don't know that I have anything about that specifically. Tom, you know, is that the same idea?
Same
word? So yeah, I'm sure it's that same kind of idea. Be kind of a coincidence for him to use the same language within a couple sentences. All right, well, anything else about this before we return to verse 3 and get things back in order? Barry, did you have your hand up? Tom?
It does make me think of 1 Corinthians 12:13, where Paul said, "By one Spirit you've been immersed into one body." It's a similar kind of idea, the one body.
Well, verse 3, the magical missing verse. Eager to maintain the spirit in the bond of peace, and that brings us back to our second participle. It's this picture of maintaining the unity of God's people, which again is kind of the driving force behind this idea of being this united people. That's the first element of what it means to walk worthy of the calling. But I would also suggest that this is perhaps something of an odd exhortation for Paul to make here. After all, the unity is created by the Spirit, he seems to have said, and it is as indestructible as God Himself. And so what he says on the heels of this is, well, it's created by the Spirit, it's as indestructible as God, so you people need to maintain it. Now, I don't know about you, but you put those things together, and that seems a little strange. We have to maintain it? If it comes from God and it's as indestructible as God, then why do we have to maintain it? Why doesn't it just take care of itself? And I can't help but think that maybe, at least conceptually, this is a parallel sort of idea to our salvation in some regard. Our salvation is a gift that is freely offered by God. And when we have received it, no one can take it away from us. We cannot be taken out of the hand of God. Yet we are to maintain our salvation as well. And I think maybe that's the same kind of idea that is behind this picture of maintaining the unity. It's what God wants us to have. It's the gift that God offers. And if we do the right kinds of things and we have the right kind of attitude, nothing can shake our unity. But it does take maintenance on our part to be the kind of people that we should be, to have the kind of love that we've talked about already. It's not just going to happen if we sit back and do nothing about it. Guy?
Does the phrase unity of the Spirit suggest unity that is brought out by the Spirit, unity that's characteristic of the Spirit?
It could suggest about a million different things. Construction. You have this of that. There are always a lot of interpretive options. On top of that, you have the question of whether the Spirit here is a capital S Spirit or a lowercase s Spirit, and that doubles the options on top of it. I've understood it to be the unity that is from the Spirit, but I could very well be wrong. So, Tom, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, best guess for a noun that has a verbal identity is it's either the subject or the object of the action. So either the Spirit is creating unity, or we are making the Spirit united, which that's a ridiculous idea. So I think you're right.
Okay.
That the Spirit brings about unity.
Okay. Colossians 3:14 says, love is the bond of unity. So that's the binding force.
Yeah. And that brings us back to verse 2, which for some reason naturally comes right before verse 3. We are to be eager to do this, he says, and this is, from what I understand, an emphatic verb. The New English Bible translates it to spare no effort. It's been suggested that the part of speech may suggest the idea of a continuous, diligent kind of activity. One commentator that I was reading, he said, it's hardly possible to render exactly the urgency contained in the underlying Greek verb. Not only haste and passion, but a full effort of the whole man is meant, involving his will, sentiment, reason, physical strength, and total attitude. The imperative mood of the participle found in the Greek text excludes passivity, quietism, a wait-and-see attitude, or a diligence tempered by all deliberate speed. Yours is the initiative. Do it now. Mean it. You are to do it. Such are the overtones of verse 3. And this is the picture of the eagerness that we are to have in this regard.
Sounds like zeal.
Yeah, a little bit like zeal. Barry?
Well, it seems all these things that he's asked about love, humility and gentleness and bearing with one another, those things don't come naturally. Those are things that we have to work at and really develop within ourselves. So to say you have to keep going, it's mean you've got to keep trying at these things. And, you know, we all want to make excuses for why that's not cool and I did this and I did that. It's that diligence in continuing to have those characteristics and display them even in times when you could lose your cool, I would say.
Anything else?
Practical application of every relationship. You take a marriage relationship, everybody wants a good marriage. They want to get along, have peace in their home. But how many people are willing to invest the kind of effort to actually have a good relationship? And the same thing is true of every other relationship. You know, we all kind of wish for peace, you know, in congregations among the Lord's people, but Paul is calling us to apply our absolute best effort, you know, no stops of all this. Flat out, try everything we can to have the kind of relationship.
Yeah. And obviously, I think primarily this has application to a congregation. This is a congregational exhortation. Now, there may be some idea of it extending at least conceptually beyond that, especially if, as we talked about way back at the beginning, Ephesians is understood as a circular letter. It was going to several congregations there in the Asian area. And that's not to say that, you know, we're blurring lines from one congregation to the next, but to show the same spirit of love to other Christians that you show to the Christians that you would assemble with regularly. And so there may be something of a larger application there as well. But of course, and the caveat will end on this, and it's one of those things that probably doesn't need to be said, but it probably should be said anyway, and that is that obviously you don't sacrifice the truth. You don't sacrifice the faith, what God has demanded. Those things aren't to be sacrificed to achieve unity. That's not what unity is. If it's not built out of God's character, and if you're sacrificing the truth, obviously you're not building it out of God's character anymore. It's not the right kind of unity. But again, it is this unity that's built on humility and submissiveness, and all of that is part of the Christian, not only in regards to one another, but in regards to what the message from God is as well. Well, we'll stop there, and we'll talk next time about how the Christian unity is enriched by the diversity of our gifts. Thank you for your attention and comments.